across the galaxy. This is where conspiracy on the wild side meets the perspective of a lifetime. This is the Free Zone with your host, Freeman.
Hello and welcome to the Free Zone. Well, we are staring down the great divide, aren't we, folks? Alienation is standing upon us and we are all separated. We're separated by false ideologies, you know? We either want to attack the power or just not be here anymore. There's an epidemic of loneliness and suicide going on while masked, hooded thugs are running in our streets throwing cemented milkshakes at people or hitting them over the head with clubs. Meanwhile, others are seeking attention by licking ice cream in grocery stores. The president's either a rapist or a racist, a hero or a savior. Family separation on so many levels is occurring at this very moment. I mean, does bringing pedo rings down solve our problem? Could Bill Clinton be a victim? Are we becoming eugenicists? I mean, reality itself is in question at this time. Is it all a deep fake? Well, today we're going to look at mastering ourselves, finding the hidden solutions within ourselves in this problem to cure this dichotomy. We're talking with Garrett Daly. He's a host on masterthyself.com. He's formerly a home-free, do-it-yourself philosopher. He believes that you can't understand this universe without first understanding yourself. Know thyself. And to that end, he has committed a lifelong journey to become the best version of himself. But in this process, he's creating a community for others who wish to do the same. So please welcome to the Free Zone, Garrett Daly. Hey, Garrett.
How's it going? Happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, glad to have you, man. It's a crazy time. It's a crazy time to be alive on planet Earth.
Oh, you can say that again. It's getting crazier, it looks like.
Oh, man, is it ever going to end? And, you know, it really does seem it's all in our minds. I mean, if you look at just, I mean, not to get political, but to look at what President Trump has done to the alienation of people, I've never seen such an effect of one symbol, we'll call him an icon, of whichever side you want to be on. And this has destroyed relationships, families. You know, if you support Trump, you might get beat up in the street. If you don't support Trump, you might be loved. It's a crazy, crazy time to try and figure out how to fix the problem while these issues are just constantly on people's minds. You can't seem to escape this dichotomy and free yourself to find the true life's soul's purpose, right? I don't know. There's a question in there somewhere.
Well, so the first thing that really stands out to me is that you have two completely contradictory worldviews that emerge out of that, right? He's kind of, ironically, I don't think that any of the postmodernists or the post-structuralist people that kind of led to the academic climate that we have today would agree with this, but I think he is, in reality, the postmodern president, in the sense that you have this complete lack of objective reality when it comes to him, right? Right. You have two totally different approaches to what he is that have nothing in common. There's no way to translate either of them together, right? They, for one, what's the Harry Potter line? If for one of you to live, the other has to die. And you have these two competing worldviews that both mirror each other, and they're kind of symbiotic in a dark sense, but neither of them can accept any of the other side's things being true by virtue of their existence.
Right. Exactly. There's just no way to bring it together. And to suggest to people that if they were to work on themselves, that these problems would resolve themselves, they look at you like you're green. And try to make people understand that there is a human home, you know, like every animal builds its nest. Humans would do the same. But I mean, I see a lot of it due to the World Wide Web and the fact that we have got so much data now and just everything's in your face immediately. Whereas pre-World Wide Web, you got your news, you might hear about something, you know, now everybody's getting involved in everything. And as they were, you know, trying to get attention, they'll run into grocery stores and rampantly lick ice cream. Right?
Well, definitely. I mean, if you think, one of the things that we have an excess of knowledge and a lack of wisdom, right? We've got all of this stuff coming out and there's just a torrent of information. Most of it's just straight up useless. Some of it is useful, but we don't have the tools to parse out which is which. Usually that's kind of what the media would do in a positive environment. But because we're sitting on this culture where everyone is pushing an agenda, I mean, that's all built on like Bernays' theory of, you know, marketing came from him and a lot of propaganda came from him. You know, there's like Gramscian political theory where you're manipulating the media streams and stuff. And we're kind of, normally we outsource this stuff. You know, the average person, realistically, like in a perfect world, the average person is fully individualized and capable of doing everything himself. But I think that's a bit of a pipe dream. So the second tier down from that, like the next best thing is, well, it'd be nice if we had reasonable media sources that gave us stuff that we need to know so that we can live effectively. And that's even less realistic. It's pretty obvious that any sort of mainstream media, even the stuff that the people who like lament the mainstream media, the next tier down of them also are part of what I would call mainstream. They're all pushing like really narrow-minded narratives in a way that I think we're starting to see die out. And I think we're starting to see kind of a grassroots movement as technology becomes more democratized and more liberating than, you know, like right now you have five or six companies that directly or indirectly control all of the media streams in the world. So like Twitter, Google, Facebook, there's a couple other ones that are big out there, right? But now, or at least I think in the next 10, 20 years, we're going to see decentralized social media platforms emerge where you don't have that, you know, Mark Zuckerberg or Jack Dorsey, someone sitting at the top of the heap saying, oh, well, this is the narrative that we want to have and this is one we don't. And we're going to ban these people and we're going to ban these words and we're going to flag these key phrases and stuff. I think we're going to move away from that, but we're in that in-between period of real weird, sketchy stuff. And it's probably going to get worse before it gets better, I think.
Yeah, no doubt. This Epstein scandal is definitely putting a dark mark on everything. It's got, I mean, you start throwing something like pedivores, right? Baby eaters, baby rapist into people's cognitive dissonance. And they're suddenly discovering, oh my God, these leaders are all running pedophile rings and they're pointing their finger at anybody and everybody to try and say that here's the, you know, the moment that your reality is crashed like that, it's hard for people to know where to go. I mean, that seems like something that's just too much information for people to handle when they're not ready for it.
Well, how do you deal with something like, you know, basically what we're seeing is the final death throes of traditional forms of authority, right? So back in the day, you had some kind of kingship and you had like, I was actually just writing about this today. That'll be out probably this week or next week, but you had kingship and they had their kind of whatever narrative that they worked on or inherited where they said, hey, we have a direct line between us and some form of divinity. And that's kind of where you get like the divine right of kings. And then America said, well, we don't want to have kings anymore. So we're going to have a constitution. And one of the unintended consequences of that is that we kind of cheapened authority a bit. And I'm not advocating for a return to like a you know, a theocratic monarchy, but I'm just pointing out kind of where we, that what happened when we transitioned. Cause most governments had some kind of theocratic element to it like that. So we lose kind of the divine justification for why the government is the way it is. We move more towards democracy. more people voting, more cheapening of the governmental systems. You know, the president doesn't have the kind of grandeur and authority that a divinely justified king does, right? And as we keep pushing through, we start to see, well, politicians go from being pretty noble. Like back in the day, you know, the founding fathers were badasses. You have the that kind of really exceptional people that were leaders. And nowadays, they're all clowns, you know. It's become commoditized. It's become something that you can't really trust any of them. And you start to see as these institutions of power erode that the leaders themselves just become more and more degenerate and more like, you know, everyone knows that politics is corrupt. So the only people that get into it are going to be corrupt people because they just say, oh, well, that's just part of the game. That's just how it's played, you know? And I mean, that just makes, I don't know, I guess it's not super surprising. Someone posted a thread on Twitter about this recently, but suggesting the whole Epstein thing was actually like a massive system of bribes under the behind the scenes to, you know, lure powerful figures into compromising situations and then have them pay him bribes to keep them safe. So I think there's I don't know. I'm not super up to date on that beyond that thread that I read, but it seems like it wouldn't surprise me if there was a massive network of like holding people in check with the kind of mechanisms of that.
Totally standard operating procedures. But yet, you know, a lot of people still stand strong in this American ideal, and to have something of this nature, this horror tossed into their reality without knowing who you are, it's very disturbing and unable for, you know, people aren't able to process this. And it causes this cognitive dissonance of what they really want, where they stand. And so now we've got this huge separation between everybody. I mean, everybody's got their own identity politic and they want to force it onto anyone else, or they don't know any other solutions to seeing something like this horror than to either fight or flight. So what are some of the methodologies that people could apply when, you know, really they have no effect on Epstein, on Trump, on anything that's being presented to them? They really can't do anything about it, but they need to do something for themselves because this is heady, heady, heavy information, you know?
Right. So there's a, you're talking about this, kind of the emergence of the identity politics. And I have a theory regarding that kind of stuff. And well, I'll tie this into how we can make a difference, but we got to understand what we're dealing with first. Right. So there's a process that I call fragmentation and reconciliation, right? So every now and then you get whether it's a cultural figure, maybe it's an inventor, maybe it's some kind of political revolutionary, it can be a social revolutionary, but you get somebody that kind of brings everything together in a way that we really resonate with, right? They've kind of simplified and streamlined and cleaned up a lot of the loose ends that we're dealing with at any point in time. I call that reconciliation, right? So we get periods like that. I would say that an easy example, maybe not the best example, but the easiest one is kind of what Steve Jobs did for technology. There were, you know, back before, I'm sure you remember, and I'm sure your viewers remember, before the iPhone, there were 400 different kinds of phones. They're all different shapes and sizes and colors. And then there's phones after the iPhone, and they're all mostly black rectangles, right? Kind of simplified the whole thing and gave us, well, this is the core stuff you need. And then you can play with that, but flip phones are probably dead now. You don't really get the other stuff because they're kind of failed offshoots. And so that's kind of the same way, broadly speaking, that genetics works. And obviously we're genetic creatures. We're, you know, built on this kind of evolutionary basis. We mutate, we try out different niches, we do small variations, and we all kind of explore that. But every now and then there's a branch in the tree of life that's a bigger branch. You know, you get there were a bunch of pre-human hominids that all died out, except for the one that led to us, because it was the best. So we're kind of at a hyper-fragmentation point in culture, right? We have no shared source of identity anymore. The last, like, cohesive source of identity was the, like, being an American. Anyone could become an American if you moved to America, right? You could become a citizen, and then even if you were, you know, we weren't perfect at this, obviously. We're, you know, early America was pretty racist, and there was still some religious persecution, but compared to everyone else in the world, we were, most people could go to America, become an American, and then subordinate whatever their little identity was to the larger ideal of, you know, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So because we've kind of grown, or we're growing away from that, or the nature of culture is shifting, we're looking for a new way to define ourselves. And we feel so, you know, most people have no connection to their history, their culture, their family. Like, I only know about my family as high as, you know, I met one of my great grandparents and that's it. I don't, you know, we have no ongoing family story. There's no narrative to place us in the world. I don't have any relation to any of the cultures that I'm from. It's just America, whatever America's commodified culture is, right? So we're at a period of extreme fragmentation. Everyone's going and trying to find their own little identity. And sometimes this is a political identity. So you pick a party and you stick with them. A more extreme example of this is like the intersectionality, where everyone has hyper fragmented identities. Like, oh, I'm, here's my ethnicity, but it's also my sexual orientation and something that I made up. And then here's some other things that I've kind of cobbled together into this extremely unique identity that is almost useless, because it has no, you can't compare things that are that uncommon. You've just made, you know, you made something ultra specific, and it's only useful in this kind of weird modern sense. It's not like you can't say, oh, well, let's look historically at other people with this identity, right? There are none. You just made it up. So I think it's like, you know, some people would say, oh, well, they're just like doing this out of spite, or they're doing it to fight back. It's like, I don't think that's the case. I think that whatever direction we take, some people, and you get darker kinds of tribalism from this, right? Some people are moving towards like ethno-nationalism or bringing back racism, xenophobia, because they're basing their identity in these other kinds of sources, right? So your country or your race or your skin color or your religion or whatever, you get more religious extremism, you get more like intersectional extremism, that kind of stuff. Because we're all looking for, who am I? Why do I matter? How do I fit into all this? Right. So this leads to what I call, and what I think is the way out. It's a combination of a couple different things. I would call it broadly integration, but you could also use Carl Jung's term, individuation, which is the process of becoming an individual, like a genuine individual, not just, you know, the example I like to use is, if you're the kid that goes and buys all your clothes at Hot Topic and now you look like, you know, the emo kid, well, you might look like an individual, but you're not really one, because anyone else can buy the same shirt. You know, individuality is something internal. It's something that we develop, and it's something that we discover. So through this, the overarching process of integration, you have to start by looking at yourself, genuinely looking at yourself, figuring out, okay, well, there are things that make me different. There are things that I have in common with people. There are things about myself that I don't know yet. And that kind of brings us into the overarching theme of master yourself, or know thyself, right? You learn who you are and you develop that, and you start to take a lot of different things, like bits of philosophy, bits of spirituality, bits of science, bits of history, you know, mythology, all this kind of stuff. And you start to apply it by integrating it into your life. So the difference between a person who is and isn't integrated, right? A person who hasn't integrated concepts into their life, well, they could say, oh, I support the right to free speech, but all they ever do is, you know, maybe retweet a petition online, or like a post that says, yeah, free speech. A person who's integrated their belief, and they understand that belief has to lead to action. Belief has to be this mobilized, actualized thing, is going to be out there, you know, A, speaking freely, actually, you know, supporting people who have an important message and might, you know, maybe be censored or not have a platform. They're going to go and, you know, defend these rights against the people who might see them removed. And there's kind of this, basically, a lot of the things that we believe in the modern world have no, we can believe stuff at a very, there's a very low bar for what we consider to be useful belief, right? So, okay, cool. You believe in all kinds of rights and stuff, but you're not going to fight for them. You don't, you're not going to do anything about them. So do you really believe in it? Or are you just saying that because there's, you know, nobody's calling you out on it, right?
Right.
So I don't know. That was a bit of a rant. So where do you want to go with that?
Oh, I don't mind at all. No, that's where we're at. You know, okay. So you're in school, you're a kid in school and you're highly intelligent, but you don't know this. You have no idea that your thought processes are different than others. You begin over the years to watch the others struggle in class and you wonder why they can't do algebra. You get jealousy projected at you. You're bullied throughout school and you don't know why. It takes you years upon years to kind of gather together the amount of data to go, oh, I'm smarter than they are. I didn't know that. And yet you've had to live a whole life of trauma of going through this institutionalized system that one is just at too slow of a pace for an intelligent person. And then also all of the fact that they've got us all stuck in singular age groups. So there's no integration of age groups going on. So it really takes a lot of time for someone to recognize who they are, because they have to compare it to other people and then try to figure out why their brains aren't working like the other brains. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a big part of what we're talking about here is the recognition of who you are is not something that you can do internally on your own, because you don't know the differences between what's going on in your head and what's going on in others' heads.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. So you, there's, depending on whose version you take, there's a bunch of different, ways of like organizing all the developmental stages. The way I kind of, I have a fairly simple one. You can get more in detail than this, but broadly this one, I think for most purposes works pretty well. So you have the early childhood, or let's just say the childhood stage, right? Where you are mostly identified with your parents. You're kind of, this is what I was taught, so this is who I am. And this is the, if let's say you have two kids, right? And it, like it's the cat in the hat, actually. So the parents go away and there is the kids and there's the fish in the fishbowl, right? And the kids are like trying to play with the cat in the hat and do all the crazy stuff. And the fish is like, oh no, your parents wouldn't like that very much at all. You should just do what they say and we'll have no fun and blah, blah, blah. And that he's a big buzzkill, right? Wet blanket. So the early childhood or the childhood stage is kind of like that. You basically, in the absence of rules, you default to what you were taught. You do not have an independent identity from the parent. And that's a lot of kids really don't ever go very far past that. The next stage is the adolescent phase, which is rebelliousness, right? So that's exemplified by the cat in the hat. He's breaking the rules. He's the cool kid kind of thing. He, you know,
let's go lick some ice cream in the grocery store.
There you go.
Sorry, right? I can't get over that one, right?
I know. That was so nasty. Oh, man. So you get the rebellion, because it's basically there's a philosophical thing called that Hegel came up with, Hegelian dialectic, which is thesis, meaning here's the thing. Antithesis is here's the opposite of the thing. And synthesis is let's put the two things together in a creative way, right? That's how you get new stuff. So you have the kid and the kid's like, oh, I'm going to do what the parents said. Mom and dad are gone. So let's do, you know, follow the rules. antithesis is mom and dad are gone, so let's jump on the bed and tear up the house and paint everything pink, right? And then adulthood is realizing, well, there are some of the rules that were good and some of the rules were bad because our parents are imperfect. So we're going to, you know, use our judgment to decide appropriately for each situation, right? Now, we have a generation that is stuck in one of those two phases. So you have these people that never question anything, and their approach to basically all of modernity is, well, if we just kept doing things the way that we always did them, then it would have worked. But of course, here we are having done that, and yet there's still problems in the world, right? The alternative is, oh, there are no rules anymore. And these are the people that came from Nietzsche. As Nietzsche said, God is dead, so we have to make up our own values. We have to make up our own rules. He called this the transmigration of values. I forget. But basically, it resolves to make up your own rules, decide our own values. We can do what we want now because the old hierarchy of society's values, which were Judeo-Christian values, is gone. We can't justify that anymore. So both of these have resulted in you get conservatives that more or less will be forced to not believe in science because science has changed the way that we look at the world. And then you get hyper liberal types or progressive, I would say progressive is a better word, that say, oh, well, because of science, we're not tied to any of the old rules anymore because they're all bad and dumb.
The earth is flat.
Yeah. There you go. So you get very strange stuff come out of that. But realistically, what the logical conclusion and one of the ways forward would be is, hey, we have some of the old stuff that worked and it was good, but maybe not for the reasons we thought it was good. And some of the new stuff worked and maybe some of the way that we're doing stuff now is better, but we haven't figured out how to do it right yet. And if we combine the two of those, we get this mature, you know, adult state of mind where we can use both of them as necessary. But that's really hard for people because they have so much invested in one identity or the other, right? So if you're the kid who doesn't want to do anything when your parents are gone, well, obviously the kid who's rebelling is bad and you feel good because you're not the bad kid, right? And the kid who's rebelling says, you're a square, you're a loser. I'm the cool kid. I get to do what I want, right? And that's kind of reinforcing because what we're doing in those early developmental stages is defining ourselves by someone else. So the child is defining themselves by the parent and the rebellious kid is defining themselves as the opposite of the parent, right?
Right.
So you get stuck. You get stuck.
We can see that clearly, that there's psychological boundaries where people are trapped into. And the idea of like taking this to the synthesis of creative play. I mean, okay, right now, supposedly hundreds of thousands, I don't know, I've seen every number from 10,000 to hundreds of thousands of people there's this plan to storm Area 51, right?
That's brilliant right there.
Some say this is, yeah, exactly. Some say this is just an internet joke and it's not really even being planned or anything. Some are, you know, ready to go storm the castle. And what my thought on this was the idea of creative play. Because the idea of going and storming Area 51 is a creative play idea. But to attack it, is this stopgap that we're talking about. Creative play would be going in there and without violence in your heart, without any sort of expectations, going there to just see what you can get away with without getting shot or without harming any others. But the idea that I didn't really mean to focus on Area 51. It was just one of the current versions where people could get involved and come in at it with a creative play mindset, change things. Like I've gone to a protest, 500,000 people in the street, you know, with their signs saying, you know, end the IMF, end the WTO, and, you know, boils down sometimes into battles between them and the riot squads. But in general, the entire group out there of 500,000 people are actually running around having a great time. You see all of these paper mache pigs and all the artwork that they had done. They put a lot of effort into this. And of course, me going to this event was sure just purely for that camaraderie experience, you know, the streets of DC with 500,000 people just taking over the streets, you know, when does that happen? But I certainly didn't expect it to end the IMF or WTO or to even affect the minds of the multitudes around the country. But you could see how much art and how much creative play came out of this. And I think that the answer lies more there.
Yeah, in a sense. I mean, that's Nietzsche had kind of this idea about this. I mean, he was very poetic. So a lot of the stuff he said could have been clearer if he wasn't trying to show off. But he had this idea that you have three stages of development, the first of which is a camel. And the camel is the old world. So give me a load to bear, right? Because camels are load-bearing animals. They can wander through the desert. They can endure the supreme heat of everything. Then the next stage was a lion, because the lion is rejecting all of that, and he's vicious, and he's proud, and he's this noble thing, right? But the third stage was a child, because the child is at play, and the child is kind of this symbol of kind of this enlightened innocence, where by playing and by engaging with things in a natural way that you're inclined to do so is somehow better than the really manufactured way that we do it. So I think there's definitely some truth to that. I mean, even look at jazz music, you know. Jazz musicians are ostensibly the best of all the musicians, as far as the genre itself is so complex. And if you try to break it down into theory and rules and all that stuff, it's almost impossible to learn it like that. But most of them, especially the early jazz musicians, didn't come up with it because they knew all the theory in that. Some of them couldn't even read music. They came up with it because they could play it, and they were playing with it. And it was, and that's why, you know, the real meaning of like playing music is it's this creative play.
Yeah, you can see how the art in our world has become completely mediocre. Modern art, mm-hmm, all around the globe. There's nothing to inspire. You know, the Greeks, they put so much effort into trying to inspire arete or excellence in people by, I mean, the minute structural changes so that the Parthenon is visually perfect, not constructually perfect. It had an arch to it because the mind's eye sees it differently. And, you know, this amount of effort was put into bringing about excellence in people so that every structure they saw just inspired excellence. And this was the goal. And currently that's like out the window.
Yeah, that's actually a really good angle to take on that too, because what you get, this is something I've been meaning to write about this actually, but I haven't really thought it all out yet. But I'm beginning to think that the notion of coolness, right? Like you say, oh, there's the cool kids, and there's always kind of like, I don't know about you, but when I imagine what like the archetypal cool figure is, it's like James Dean, looking like he doesn't give a shit, smoking a cigarette, kind of very nonchalant, kind of rebellious thing. And there's an element of what our concept of coolness that's like effortlessness or really not trying. And so I think as a culture, and you could, I mean, art is most definitely the place to see this, we've kind of enshrined the idea of people that don't try hard at all. Because if you think about like the greatest, you know, the absolute greatest works of art, you know, sculpture, Greek sculpture, or the Renaissance masters, or any of that kind of stuff, that is super high effort. It's the exaltation of human effort, right? It's the to take the capacity that we have for greatness and to show people, if you really put your mind to one thing and you became the best in the world, this is what it would look like. This is what the world could look like if you were only better, right? And so I think that, well, and there's another angle that you could get into with, I think this is a really interesting story. So in the Cold War, there were two kinds of art in the world. You had in Soviet Russia, you had what was called, I believe, socialist realism or Soviet realism or something like that. That was effectively, honestly, they're very cool paintings. I'm not endorsing the philosophy, but the art style is very cool. It was like this very uplifting bunch of paintings where you'd have a bunch of the workers standing in line and they're like holding up the flag or, you know, like the hammer and sickle flag or something. And it's like exalted. It's like the flag is magnificent and everyone looks happy and united. And they're showing, you know, they're painting what the picture of their ideology would be. So this perfect world where everyone's equal and happy and they're all subordinating to the iconography of the party, right? So I'm not endorsing it, but it is cool art. So what the CIA ended up doing to combat this, because the Cold War was fought ideologically on so many fronts, that the CIA funded people like, what's the Campbell Soup guy, Andy Warhol, who is, in my opinion, farcical. I think his art is not art. I think it's just crap. What did he exalt? He exalted pop culture figures and Campbell Soup cans and consumerism. And, you know, whatever you as an artist, whatever you create is saying, this is what I value the most. This is what I'm exalting. This is what I believe is the pinnacle of human existence, or this is what I see value in and choose to show you my version of, right? So some of the really great painters, they thought that light was the most beautiful thing. So their paintings all focus on the different, you know, diffused light or stuff like that. Or some people thought that cloth was one of the most beautiful things. So you get sculpture of cloth where it looks fluid, and it, even though it's stone, and I think that's incredible, you know? And then you get these different things that they're showing. Obviously, human beauty is always central to really great art, because it's the most, you know, that's the source of where we get all our ideas of beauty, because we're this beautiful living thing that's magnificent creature, right? And then what we did with that in the Cold War was we said, no, we can't let them succeed with their art. So instead of fighting them at their game, we're going to undermine the way their game works. Because that was the thing. They had a really beautiful picture, their painting of human life. So what we did is we made art ugly. We say, so, you know, the U.S. government funded different ways of making art ugly. So you get all this weird Jackson Pollock throwing paint at the wall. Like, it's not art at all. It's just nonsense. And this stuff sells for, you know, $164 million a painting. People think it's high art. There's also stuff to suggest that, like, a lot of really expensive art is actually just ways of money laundering. That's why people, you know, rich people trade art, because they can do it and move money around. But we basically annihilated art as a cultural force to fight the Soviets. And at what cost? Now look at us, you know, now we're, we're dealing with the fact that we destroyed beauty and the beauty of the human spirit. And you get people like, highly recommended, everyone go check out, Brian Larson is by far my favorite living painter. Alex Gray is a close second. But Brian Larson is a romantic realist. He does classical style paintings that are mind-boggling, and they're massive too. These are like wall-sized paintings that are perfectly realistic. They are all showing the beauty of the human spirit, people succeeding, people creating stuff. Because if you think about it, we have like pre-modern art where people were showing people and stuff, but we never adapted art to really include technology very much. And that's one thing that he does. So he'll do like classical style paintings, but it's people in spaceships or flying airplanes or building bridges. And we, I don't know, there's this weird thing where we don't see the modern world as beautiful at all. And we don't reflect that in our art. Because historically, we reflected all kinds of technologies in art, like the like weapons and spear. You know, that was primarily technology back in the day, or there were like representations of harvest and that kind of stuff. So I don't know. It's very, very interesting. And I think it's telling as to the state of our culture that we really don't like beauty anymore in the art world.
Makes me think of that Banksy painting. You know, here's a graffiti artist who's become the height of art. And he did a painting, which was a print, you know, so it was reproduced. And it was sold for, you know, $1 million. I don't remember exactly the value. But Banksy seems to have set this painting up, or the print, to have a shredder inside of the frame, which as soon as the hammer, the gavel went down and this thing was sold, the shredder was activated and it shredded it into multiple pieces. Now, the intriguing thing is this made it another original work of art and it suddenly became much more valuable.
Yeah, I think that's it. I really do like Banksy for the sake of him just lampooning these morons, because like, oh, wow, you just bought a shredded piece of paper with like a screen print on it. You're a dunce. You could easily recreate that at home. Like, that's the thing. But we don't care. People just don't care. Like, that it's, people have created this notion of art that has literally nothing to do with actual art. You know, you cannot at home, I don't care who you are, you cannot make your own Rembrandt or Picasso painting or something like that. And even Picasso is a bit more modern than I personally care for, but you can't do it. You can't do it, right?
Right.
You can try, but it's not going to have whatever that thing is.
Salvador Dali.
I love his work. He was the last great, he was a surreal realist. Like, all his stuff was realistic, but surreal. But he's a phenomenal thinker. You know, they were going to make an adaptation. It was called Jodorowsky, I think.
Jodorowsky's Dune, yeah.
Yeah, and he was going to do the art. It was going to be 7 hours long. It would have been awesome.
Yeah, he was going to be the most paid actor in Hollywood because he only had a 5-minute role.
Mm-hmm.
His part was the one that Sting ended up playing.
Yeah, and they are making a new version of Dune, though, and it's got, so far, the director's good and all the casting is good, so I am very optimistic about that for the time being. That is a book right there, let me tell you.
Yes, all right, so Achieving the Kwisatz Haderach.
That's a perfect transition, there you go. So, one of the things that I find, Dune, as far as any book goes, period, like, people say, oh, Star Wars is like this really, it's all the hero's journey, this and that. It's like, Star Wars is like the most watered down version of the hero's journey. Dune is, he goes further than some of the mystics went themselves, in my opinion. So the first thing you have that really stands out is the very beginning of the book. You have the kid and there's the religion of exclusively female witches, effectively. They're like, you know, priestesses, but some people call them witches, that they can like read minds and do all kinds of crazy mental stuff. But they're only female because the test that's required to make you one is something that only the women can pass, right? So they test the boy at an early age. And that's not just the test, but there's another phase later that only the women survive. It kills the men, right? So they test the boy with this thing called the Gamjabar. This is, I wrote about this in an article, I believe, I forget. The subtitle was Becoming Human. I forget what the title of the article was. But the Gamjabar is, it means the high-handed enemy. It's this dagger that has a drop of poison on the tip that is so lethal that it kills you instantly. And the other component of this test is a box. And the box has nothing in it. And what you do is you stick your hand in the box. All the box does is it generates the most extreme sensation of pain possible. It just starts very softly and it increases infinitely, right? And so the test is that you have to put your hand in the box. And if you take your hand out of the box because it hurts, you will be stabbed with a needle immediately and you die. And the moral or the reason behind the test, they say, is that an animal will chew its own leg off to escape a trap. But a human will lay in wait in the trap for the person who set the trap to come back, fake their own death, and kill them, right? So it's man. What makes a man, or a person, is the ability to endure pain willingly, right? And I love that. So you have to put your hand in the box, and you leave it in there until they take it out, even though it feels like your hand's being melted off of your body, right? So that's just one of the first, and that's, I think, within the first 10 pages of this long, long book. You have the tribe that lives in the desert, and they're the Fremen, or the Freemen, you know, of course. You have them wandering around. They have their interesting rituals with giant serpents, which is another fascinating symbol. And basically what is required is that the kid who passed the test, he goes and joins them, wanders around, and eventually he is inducted into this exclusively female religion, which that is centrally, I think that is the most fascinating thing in the note, the entire book. What that represents in the self is that most men live in what I call the order mind. The order mind is roughly the masculine mind. Obviously, yeah, we all have both. So there are some men that have more of a chaos mind, which we'll get into that in a second, and some women have more of an order mind. The order mind is the part of your brain that says, I have rules, I'm in control. So if you're walking through your house at night and it's well lit, you're not scanning for threats. You assume you know what's going on. You feel secure. You have rules. Oh, well, this is the living room. This is what should be in here, right? That kind of stuff. On the other side, you have the chaos mind. And this is more more commonly feminine. I try not to speak in absolutes because there are always exceptions. Some dudes are very feminine. Some chicks are extremely masculine. The chaos mind is the place where you say, I am not in control of the situation, so I'm going to be observant and see what's going on. Right? So the chaos mind is how we determine social stuff. This is why dudes are notoriously bad at picking up subtext in conversations with women, because women imply stuff and they hint at stuff, and dudes just say, oh, well, here's a really straightforward thing, right? So yes. What do you want to eat? Oh, I don't know. That doesn't mean I don't know what I want to eat. That means I want you to pick somewhere and tell me where that's where we're going. But the dude hears that and says, you don't know where you want to eat. Here's a place. Oh, I don't know about that. Here's another place. Oh, I don't know. And that's eternally, this is the way the mind works, because you have one side that has rules and wants to decide, and everything's verbal and everything's logical. It's very clean and cut out and put into boxes, and it makes sense. And we just get it. If you just don't get it, everything's straightforward. Why don't you just get it, right? And then on the other side, you have it's emotion. Emotion, and interestingly enough, actually, the verbal part of the brain is on one side and the emotional part of the brain is on the other side, which means that we can speak without accessing emotions very easily. It's easy to have a purely verbal conversation, right? And especially if you're two dudes talking about a car, you could just talk about that. There's no subtext about how's the car feeling, right? Is the carburetor angry? Is it giving me a sideways glance, right? You have none of that. On the other hand, you have all this emotion that's not easily articulated in words. So dudes, since we tend to inhabit the order mind, are bad at accessing this. So a lot of the time, since we can't describe it in words, a lot of the times either we have emotions act on us and we're not aware of it, meaning you get dudes with emotional outbursts when they think they're being rational, or you have emotions that we can't put into words. So this is why dudes are bad at talking about their feelings largely, right? So if I'm feeling something and it's not touching the verbal part of my brain, I can't talk to you about it. I can't explain it, right? We only get those things indirectly. So this is a part of the things that, like, when people have therapy, you listen for clues and you try to piece all the stuff together, because people end up explaining things indirectly. And that's why when you say, oh, I don't know what I'm hungry for, there's probably some clues somewhere else that leads to the actual answer, but the feeling of hunger and the end result verbal sentence, oh, I want to go to Chipotle, are two separate things entirely, right? So in Dune, you have this exclusively female intuitive superpower religion of the Bene Gesserit, they're like witches, right? And the dude is the guy that goes through and survives the process that normally kills all the men, because it's the process of entering chaos. It's entering the underworld, like Jordan Peterson talks about. It's to go into the world of emotion and to feel everything. And that normally kills people. It breaks people, right? Because it's so... The masculine mind is so largely clean and simple and ordered and not random at all, you know? And this is where you get autism is a hyper-masculine mind that says, I have so many rules for everything, and they make everything makes so much sense that I cannot understand anyone else's worldview, because I only understand my own rules, right? And there's no accounting for emotion whatsoever. And if you go, that's I call that order mind solipsism, but that's autism, right? You go the other way and you have chaos mind solipsism, which says, I have no rules at all, but I can only think about me. So everything must have to do with me. And what you end up doing is you think, well, hey, that old lady sitting in her car across the street, she's got to be spying on me. I bet it's the cops, right? Because that's where schizophrenic types end up building these entire worldviews where everyone's persecuting them or everyone's out to get them, because they don't know any better. They don't have that kind of safe place to stand in the order mind where you say, okay, I know what's going on. I have some rules. I get it. I'm not worried about maybe there's a person hiding under the couch in my living room. It's probably not likely, right? And that's what the order mind does. The order mind says, no, I know this room. The room is safe. We're good. The chaos mind says, what if? So you get in Dune, you get this figure that is able to understand the order mind. He's the masculine force, but he can go through into the feminine experience and understand that, withstand the storm of it. And because of this, he becomes the messianic figure. And so what's interesting is you get in, there's a really, really fascinating painting that I cannot remember the name of, but it's a painting of Jesus in a church. And it's a very asymmetrical painting, even though it's of his face and he's looking straight at you. One side of his face is hyper-masculine. It's got a much squarer jaw, a sharper eye. He looks aggressive. And the other side of his face is more feminized. It's very soft, and the chin is more slender and all of that. And so there's this idea that you get in mysticism and esoterica that the perfect person is the master of two worlds. It's someone that's balanced out order and chaos. And this is where what we call, my philosophy, you have the order mind, the chaos mind, but what you're really striving for is the third eye. But that's not the literal third, like the pineal gland. This is the place where you can use, well, I call it the two blind eyes that come together to create one eye that can see, right? So you can switch between the order mind, the chaos mind at will as necessary to adapt. And you don't get caught unaware like the order mind can be. And you don't live in total, total chaos all the time like the chaos mind can be.
Sounds about like the world right about now.
Well, that's it. You know, the order mind is the child, and the chaos mind is the adolescent, right? Because the order mind says, oh, mom and dad left us some rules. We better follow the rules. The adolescent or the chaos mind says, oh, there are no rules. We can do whatever we want, right?
It seems in that you also have, I feel safe. I have a protector. I don't feel safe. I'm going to run rampant.
Yeah. Well, think about it. That was what conservatives see Trump as, a strong patriarchal figure, because they're lean order mind, right? And the other side sees him as this dangerous force because they don't feel safe with him. And that's the chaos mind side of things. So it ends up being, it's fascinating because it maps so well to pretty much every paradox or debate where there are two sides, any kind of dichotomy, they map with this concept so well. Because what ends up happening is like the dude and the chick trying to decide on where to go eat. They're literally speaking two different languages, right?
Yeah.
So it's because of that. That's the trick. I don't know, in an interesting sense, is that that makes every controversial figure is actually both of what is said about them, and actually is also neither. It's just one side is the emotional response and one side is the verbal logical response, right? And these are two different languages entirely.
I know that far too well. Why don't you just tell me? I could have figured this out. I could have done it. I unfortunately know that way too well.
I'm sure every man listening to this knows.
Yes.
And all the women are like, that's not why, you know, they're mad about it. But, you know, that's the great paradox of human life is that we're split into such a way as to endlessly aggravate each other, because it's out of that aggravation that new things come about.
Right. Yeah, that's the truth. You know, on FreemanTV.com, I always have this image of Manly P. Hall's library doors. And I display this constantly because I find it kind of fits what we're saying here and what I've always felt, because it has a reptilian man standing there holding an acorn or a pine cone, the pineal gland. Mm-hmm. And it has a fish-like man holding what basically looks like a phallus on a cane. And the reptilian with the acorn or with the pine cone is Plato, and the fish man with the phallus is Confucius. And so these two doors are separating the ideas of reason and emotion. And you have to walk through the both of them to enter Manly P. Hall's library.
That's a great, I mean, that's a very obscure metaphor, but that is the perfect, same exact concept, you know? And that's, I think the interesting thing, this is where I think we went wrong as a culture. We, because of the nature of reason and the products of reason, we've advanced technology and everything. And this isn't like an anti-technology spiel. To clarify, because it will sound like one for a minute, but
you're leading us perfectly into the next segment, so go ahead.
Awesome. So what we went wrong with is that we advanced technology so fast that we were not able to adapt the other parts of the world that we need so desperately, meaning we don't know how to feel in modern times. Men don't, and this isn't, now this is where people get it twisted, because people say like, oh, men should all like, we should all like cry and have feelings and express ourselves. And like, you know, it's like, no, you're imagining what if men were like women, right? That's a naive way of looking at it. What the real way of looking at it is that we've so prioritized a form of masculinity that is out of touch with any sort of emotion that we, it's like a naive concept of what a man is. So when you have like a kid, and kids are emotional and they feel and they have all this stuff before the world makes them hard, right? You imagine, well, oh, the macho guy, he doesn't care what anyone thinks, and he does whatever he wants, and he hurts people's feelings, but he doesn't care. And then you get like dudes that are bad with chicks, and they say, oh, all the guys that succeed are assholes, and they don't care what chicks think, so they just say mean stuff. It's like, no, you're kind of missing the point. That's a naive understanding, you know, of what it looks like to be a developed individual. So when you only see that kind of stuff from the naive perspective, well, then you think it's cold, ruthless emotion, intellect, right? Cold reason, pure reason. And that's kind of where we went. So we have this culture that's so focused on that stuff to the detriment of the development of the person in a way where they can feel emotions and access that kind of, like, intuition is primarily that's more of a chaos mind thing. It's connecting dots. It's intuitive. It's a non-linear way of putting ideas together that ends up actually working, I think, a lot better than a lot of people's rationality some of the time, because it's intuition that allows you to connect unlike things, right? And that's a chaos mind strength. that people don't have. So you get all these people that are hardcore specialists in the world, right? Like, hey, I'm going to go study for my entire career, I'm just going to study the social dynamics of chimpanzees regarding when they eat a certain kind of fruit. And that's going to be my whole career. I'm going to study this for 45 years, right? This one weird specific thing. And this is, I'm going to be called an expert and everyone's going to hold me up as a paragon of how you should study things. It's like, no, the world isn't just one specific thing. You can't just have your little set of rules. There's chaos. There's all kinds of stuff you need to embrace. You need to study variously between disciplines, but that's a chaos mind trait. And we don't prioritize that. We have very little tiny boxes we want to put everything in, which is all order mind dominance, right? Everyone has a place in the hierarchy and they all fit here and I know what the rules are and I don't have to question it. Because that's what scares the order mind is maybe I'm wrong. Maybe my little boxes aren't right. And then, oh, what do I do then? Because you're kicked into the chaos mind and then you have to feel things. Feeling things is scary. Feeling things is hard, right? So that's kind of where we went. We went, because of the speed of technology, we went so far in the direction of the order mind. And I would hazard a guess. I'm not proclaiming this, but I would hazard a guess that the rise in autism is also much more prevalent in men, but the rise of autism is because the world is actually becoming autistic. It's becoming far too centered in the order mind.
Well, that is a perfect place for us to leap off into the next segment. So why don't you tell everybody, I'll tell them first, masterthyself.com is the website where you will find the work of Garrett Daly. And it is a plethora of articles on mind and understanding and a philosophy that can start to bring about this cohesion of the order and chaos, and maybe we can find our tribe and get back home. Who knows? We're going to get deep into our reality in question and this advancement that has come upon us so fast in so many ways, not just technologically, but emotionally, that we're going to have to deal with in these next few years. And so I'm really looking forward to our continuation of this discussion. But Garrett, tell people how they can find you, how they can connect with you, and anything that you'd like to share.
Yeah, you can find me. I'm primarily active on Twitter. So that is at Libera, Libera underscore Rex on Twitter. You should also, if you're on Twitter, follow my company, Ion Media Co., at Ion Media Co., no spaces, A-I-O-N Media Co. And also on Twitter for my website, I just started a Twitter for it, at MasterSelf Blog. So the website is called MasterSelf. The URL is masterthyself.com because the Russians own it, and I'm convinced they're colluding against me. But just kidding. But I'm super active on Twitter. If you DM me on Twitter, my DMs are open. I am down to talk about whatever, anything I talked about today, anything I talk about on my website. If you want to talk about it on your show, I'm down. Anyone's show, I will do whatever because I love to talk about this stuff. I'm so passionate about the nature of the mind and philosophy and culture and how that all shapes our world, and it's. That's what I'm about. So
fantastic. And the world needs you, dear Garrett. We do. And so I'm glad that we got you here on the Free Zone. And I'm got to thank Steve for pulling everything together for me all the time. Thank you, Steve, so much for being there for me. And if you guys have any guest suggestions or any love that you want to send that way, it is producersteve@freemantv.com. Of course, I'm also active on Twitter, so I hope you guys will follow me there at Freeman TV on Twitter and catch up on all the news articles. Of course, my Twitter feed is right there on freemantv.com. If you don't want to go there, it's right there for you in every article. I think I'm spreading some amazing news. I think that you want to get a hold of and look at from self-cloning killer ticks into dimensional shifts. It's all there. So come on over and check it out. And Garrett and I are going to jump over into the member section and take this a bit deeper about our reality in question. And maybe we'll get into AI, VR, you know, transhumanism. And have you seen that god-awful video from Madonna, or is she now Madam X, and her God control? I mean, there's lots to talk about, so stay tuned. If you're not yet a member, come on over to freemantv.com and subscribe. Check it out. There's 14 years of content, plus lectures and articles, and you can spend a decade on freemantv.com and never see the same thing twice. Realize this is the home of most of these strange conspiracy topics, and they will continue on. And I got to thank you guys so much for supporting my efforts, keeping me going these 14 years. And I can't say enough about it. And all I'm going to do is just keep trying my best and do everything I can to bring a cohesion to life on planet Earth, help us all find our tribe and get back home. So we will see you all next week.